students to burn their draft cards. World champion heavyweight boxer Muhammad Ali refused to fight in Vietnam, asking, "Why should they ask me to put on a uniform and go 10,000 miles from home and drop bombs and bullets on brown people in Vietnam while so-called Negro people in Louisville are treated like dogs?" And the argument against the war grew both broader and deeper when Martin Luther King joined it in 1967, severing his alliance with Johnson by declaring, "We are fighting an immoral war." Johnson lost himself in the war. Foreign policy had never been his strength, and he found out far too late that the treatment didn't work on Ho Chi Minh. By 1967, nearly 500,000 combat troops were in Vietnam. That year alone, 9,000 Americans died in Vietnam, and the war consumed $25 billion of the federal budget. To pay for it, Johnson, refusing to raise taxes, having only just convinced Congress to push through a tax cut, starved the Great Society. By the time he was finally willing to ask for a tax increase, he was only able to get it by agreeing to still more spending cuts to his anti-poverty programs. And by then, inflation had begun to surge, giving credence to economic theories endorsed by conservatives. By 1968, Robert McNamara, Johnson's Secretary of Defense and an architect of Johnson's war, no longer willing to continue, resigned. In January 1968, during Tet, the Vietnamese New Year, the North Vietnamese conducted raids all over South Vietnam, including on the U.S. Embassy in Saigon. Johnson had claimed that the North Vietnamese were weak and that the war was nearly won. The Tet Offensive exposed the depth of that lie. In March, New York Times columnist James Rustin declared, "The main crisis is not Vietnam itself or in the cities, but in the feeling that the political system for dealing with these things has broken down." While Americans reeled from news reports in Vietnam, the presidential primary season began. LBJ won the Democratic primary in New Hampshire with only 49% of the vote. An anti-war candidate, Minnesota Congressman Eugene McCarthy, had polled 42%. Emboldened by Johnson's narrow win, Robert Kennedy entered the race. Having urged Johnson in 1963 not to withdraw from Vietnam, Kennedy now ran against it as Johnson's war. George Wallace entered the race too. Johnson was being squeezed from the left and from the right, both for what was going on in American cities and for what was going on in Vietnam. Nor were the two often considered separately. In 1966, Wallace had been unable to run for re-election as governor of Alabama because of a law of succession, and had his wife Lurleen run in his stead. She won by a margin of 2-1. In 1968, when George Wallace decided to campaign for the Democratic nomination, Stokely Carmichael, speaking in Birmingham, said that if the army gives a black soldier a gun and tells him to shoot his enemy, if he don't shoot Lurleen and George and Little Junior, he's a fool. Johnson was even left to campaign against the ghost of Barry Goldwater, a billboard in Chicago that in 1964 had read, "In your heart you know he's right," read 4 years later, "Now you know he was right." Disgusted and discouraged, Johnson announced on March 31st that he would not run for re-election. He had decided to dedicate himself to ending the war. "With our hopes and the world's hopes for peace and that balance every day," he said in a televised address, "I do not believe that I should devote an hour or a day of my time to any personal partisan causes." The stunned New York Times ran a can-you-believe-it three-tier headline. Johnson says he won't run, halts North Vietnam raids, bids Hanoi join peace moves. But peace would not come, nor would moderation abide. 4 days later, on the balcony of a hotel in Memphis, Martin Luther King was shot by a white ex-convict. As word spread, riots broke out in 130 cities. From California, Reagan, granting barely a moment for mourning, declared that King's assassination was part of the great tragedy that began when we began compromising with law and order, and people started choosing which laws they'd break. Stokely Carmichael announced that white America killed Dr. King, and in the doing had declared war on black America. He told a crowd in Washington to go home and get your guns. A stricken Robert Kennedy spoke from the back of a flatbed truck in Indianapolis. "What we need in the United States is not division," he said, nervously grasping at the slip of paper on which he'd hastily scrawled some notes. "What we need in the United States is not hatred. What we need in the United States is not violence and lawlessness, but love and wisdom and compassion toward one another, and a feeling of justice toward those who still suffer within our country, whether they be white or whether they be black." 2 months later, after winning the California primary, Kennedy was shot while leaving the ballroom of a hotel in Los Angeles. The nation mourned as Job in the desert, fallen to its knees. What more? 5. Richard Nixon's moment had come. He would repurpose his anti-communism in the form of a new political rhetoric, anti-liberalism. As Reagan had done in the California governor's race 2 years before, he would stake his campaign for the Republican nomination and for the presidency on a pledge to restore law and order. "We've been amply warned that we face the prospect of a war in the making of our own society," he said in a radio address on March 7, 1968, days before the New Hampshire primary. "We have seen the gathering hate. We have heard the threats to burn and destroy in Watts and Harlem and Detroit and Newark. We have had a foretaste of what the organizations of insurrection are planning for the summer ahead." He promised that if elected, he would not cower before these threats. In New Hampshire, he received 79% of the Republican vote. Nixon knew that the more violent the riots and the worse the news from Vietnam, the better his chances. Deciding that peace would bar his road to the White House, he arranged for Anna Chenault, born in China and the widow of a U.S. general, to act as a conduit to promise South Vietnam that it would get better peace terms if it waited until after the election and a Nixon victory. Johnson heard rumors about this arrangement, called Nixon and confronted him. Nixon, lying, denied it. Johnson failed to negotiate a peace. The fighting would last for 5 more years at a cost of countless lives. By the time the bombing ended in 1973, the United States dropped on Vietnam and its neighbors, Laos and Cambodia, more than 7.5 million tons of bombs, equal to 100 atom bombs, and 3 times all the explosives. Where King and Kennedy had called for love, Nixon, like Carmichael, knew the power of hate. His young political strategist, a number cruncher named Kevin Phillips, explained that understanding politics was all about understanding who hates whom. That's the secret. Phillips' advice to Nixon was known as the Southern Strategy, and it meant winning Southern Democrats and giving up on African Americans by abandoning civil rights for law and order. As Nixon prepared for the Republican National Convention meeting in Miami in August, he listened to Phillips, who explained that the election would be won or lost on the law and order Negro socioeconomic revolution syndrome, but that there was no need to talk like George Wallace. This could all be done so much more subtly. In his acceptance speech in Miami, Nixon invoked an apocalypse. "As we look at America, we see cities enveloped in smoke and flame," he said. "We hear sirens in the night." But there was another sound, a quieter voice, a silenced voice, to which Americans ought to listen. "It is the quiet voice in the tumult and the shouting. It is the voice of the great majority of Americans, the forgotten Americans, the non-shouters, the non-demonstrators. They are not racists or sick. They are not guilty of the crime that plagues the land. They are good people, and they are decent people. They work, and they save, and they pay their taxes, and they care." The GOP adopted a platform plank that billed itself as anti-crime and anti-Kerner Commission. "We must reestablish the principle that men are accountable for what they do, that criminals are responsible for their crimes, that while the youth's environment may help to explain the man's crime, it does not excuse that crime." But as Nixon advisor John Dean later said, "I was cranking out that bullshit on Nixon's crime policy before he was elected, and it was bullshit, too. We knew it. The Nixon campaign didn't call for anything about crime problems that Ramsey Clark, Johnson's attorney general, wasn't already doing under LBJ. We just made more noise." 2 weeks after the Republicans met in Miami, the Democratic National Convention met in Chicago. Anti-war protesters arrived in Chicago, too, along with Students for a Democratic Society, yippies, anarchists, and hangers-on. They were met with a military police force of an occupying army, some 12,000 Chicago police, 6,000 National Guardsmen, 6,000 Army troops, and 1,000 undercover intelligence agents. Richard Daley, the city's mayor, insisted that law and order would prevail. There were armed police even in the convention hall. The party had no leader. Johnson had stepped down. Robert Kennedy had been shot. Johnson's vice president, Hubert Humphrey, who had not entered a single primary, won the nomination, defeating Eugene McCarthy and arousing the ire of the party's left flank. In November, Nixon beat Humphrey by winning those Americans who believed that he was speaking for them, the silent majority. The parties were being sorted by ideology, and they were being sorted by race. In 1960, about 3 out of every 5 blue-collar workers had voted Democrat. In 1968, only 1 in 3 did. In 1960, 1 in 3 African Americans had voted for Nixon over John F. Kennedy. By 1972, only 1 in 10 would vote for Nixon over the Democratic nominee, South Dakota Senator George McGovern. A mid-century era of political consensus had come to an almost unfathomably violent end. After 1968, American politics would be driven once again by division, resentment, and malice. Even Leon Baxter began to have her regrets. Interviewed in the 1960s, she warned that political consulting must be kept in the hands of the most ethical, principled people, people with real concern for the world around them, for people around them, or else it will erode into the hands of people who have no regard for the world around him. It would be a very, very destructive thing. And what of the American past? Was the schoolbook version of American history a lie? The civil rights movement and the war in Vietnam called attention to aspects of American history that had been left out of American history textbooks from the very start. The American Indian Movement, founded in 1968, challenged the story of the nation's origins. The goal of Ames' occupation of an abandoned prison on the island of Alcatraz, an occupation that lasted from the end of 1969 through the middle of 1971, was for the island to become a Native American studies center. The Black Power movement, the Chicano movement, and a growing Asian American movement made similar demands. In Denver, in 1969, Chicano activist Rodolfo Gonzalez, who'd founded the Crusade for Justice, led a walkout of Mexican American students in protest over the American history curriculum, insisting that it be revised to enforce the inclusion in all schools of this city, the history of our people, our culture, language, and our contributions to this country. Black studies departments were founded at colleges, the first in 1969 at San Francisco State, followed by Chicano studies and women's studies departments, the first founded in San Diego State in 1970, and sexuality and gender studies. A revolution on the streets produced a revolution in scholarship and a new American past. A new American history, along with a broadening of research and the social sciences and the humanities more generally, was long overdue. But in the context of the war in Vietnam, questioning academic authority and pointing out the biases of experts began to slip into a cynicism about truth itself. A great deal of university research, not only in engineering and in weapons technology, had been deployed to wage and support the war in Vietnam, a war most Americans deemed ill-judged and many considered immoral. The Cold War had asked many of the nation's scientists and scholars to turn their research to the pursuit of military and foreign policy aims. The Vietnam War had contorted the academy itself. After the Tet Offensive, Senate hearings into military spending revealed, among many other academic scandals, the extent of Simmel Maddox's work on South Vietnam, conducting public opinion surveys and analyzing the dreams of Vietnamese villagers as a way of understanding the insurgency, a project not unrelated to the company's other research on countering urban insurgency. Arkansas Senator J. William Fulbright, who convened the hearings, denounced social scientists like Ithiel de Solapool for failing to provide an effective counterweight to the military-industrial complex by strengthening their emphasis on the traditional values of our democracy, and instead having joined the monolith. Noam Chomsky, writing in the New York Review of Books in 1969, argued that much of academic life in the United States, the production of knowledge itself, had been suborned for the purpose of waging a grotesque war in which all the courage had been shown by young soldiers who fought the war, and by young students who protested it. While young dissenters plead for a resurrection of the American promise, their elders continue to subvert it, Fulbright said damningly, charging the nation's intellectuals with the surrender of independence, the neglect of teaching, and the distortion of scholarship, and accusing the university of abdicating its elemental function and not only failing to meet its responsibilities to its students, but in betraying a public trust. The academy would have its reckoning. Vietnam convinced a great many American intellectuals to withdraw from public life on the grounds that the only defensible ethical position was to refuse to engage in discussion of policy and politics. But in colleges and universities, revelations about the betrayals of the Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon administrations and about the complicity of scholars and scientists easily descended into disenchantment and a profound alienation from the idea of America itself. I learned to despise my countrymen, my government, and the entire English-speaking world with its history of genocide and international conquest, said one 60s radical. I was a normal kid. In some corners of the left, the idea that everything was a lie became a fashionable truth. Post-structuralism and postmodernism suffused not only American intellectual life, but American politics, too. If everything is politics, and politics is a series of lies, then there is no truth. Suddenly, I realized that they did not really believe there was a nature of things, the social critic Paul Goodman wrote about his students at the end of the 1960s. There was no knowledge, but only the sociology of knowledge. They had so well learned that physical and sociological research is subsidized and conducted for the benefit of the ruling class that they were doubtful that there was such a thing as a simple truth. And that was before Watergate. Meanwhile, on the right, a new political wisdom involved a new political math that produced a new and even deeper cynicism. Nixon's 1968 campaign with its Southern strategy had been singularly divisive. Almost as soon as he entered office, Nixon began thinking about his re-election, planning a still more divisive campaign that would determine the direction of his presidency. Kevin Phillips's The Emerging Republican Majority appeared late in 1969. Nixon read it over Christmas and told his chief of staff, H.R. Haldeman, "Go for Poles, Italians, Irish. Must learn to understand silent majority. Don't go for Jews and blacks." Haldeman, a Californian, had volunteered for Eisenhower-Nixon in 1952 and had left his job to manage Nixon's first presidential campaign. He'd learned how to campaign from Campaigns, Inc. "Whitaker and Baxter was the great old campaign," Haldeman once said. "The granddaddy." Democrats plotted their own path to a majority, no less interested in market segmentation. Two Democratic strategists, Richard M. Scammon and Ben J. Wattenberg, published their own manifesto just months after Phillips's book appeared. Like Phillips, Scammon and Wattenberg were using computers to study election returns and public opinion polls. In The Real Majority, 1970, the two men argued that in addition to the bread-and-butter issues that had for so long determined how citizens voted, Americans are apparently beginning to array themselves politically along the axes of certain social situations as well. The GOP was moving to the right to capitalize on backlash against civil rights, and some in the Democratic Party were planning to move to the left. Scammon and Wattenberg explained, "Under the banner of new politics, there is talk of forming a new coalition of the left comprised of the young, the black, the poor, the well-educated, the socially alienated, minority groups, and intellectuals, while relegating middle America and especially white union labor to the ranks of racists." This coalition would be a disaster for the Democratic Party, Scammon and Wattenberg predicted, and they strenuously argued against it. "The great majority of voters in America are un-young, un-poor, and un-black. They are the middle-aged, middle-class, middle-minded," they pointed out. "And the average voter, statistically speaking, was a 47-year-old Catholic housewife from Dayton, Ohio, married to a machinist. To know that the lady in Dayton is afraid to walk the streets alone at night, to know that she has a mixed view about blacks and civil rights because before moving to the suburbs she lived in a neighborhood that became all black, to know that her brother-in-law is a policeman, to know that she does not have the money to move if her new neighborhood deteriorates, to know that she is deeply distressed that her son is going to a community junior college where LSD was found on campus, to know all this is the beginning of contemporary political wisdom." Scammon and Wattenberg recommended that Democrats move to the center, though they feared that Democrats wouldn't take their advice, and they were right. But Nixon did not ignore their advice. He read an advance copy of The Real Majority 3 weeks before it was published. "The president talked about real majority and need to get that thinking over to all our people," Haldeman recorded in his notes. "Wants to hit pornography, dope, bad kids." Nixon said, "We should aim our strategy primarily at disaffected Democrats, blue-collar workers, and at working-class white ethnics, and set out to capture the vote of the 47-year-old Dayton housewife." He decided to change the course of the White House's strategy in the midterm 1970 elections, halting a campaign against Democrats as big spenders and replacing it with a campaign for the votes of blue-collar workers on the basis of social issues, from marijuana to pornography. He charged his vice president, Spiro Agnew, with pushing Democrats out of the political center by calling people like Edward Kennedy radical liberals. Nixon's staff crafted this argument into campaign rhetoric, urging him to use this message when talking to voters. "Today, racial minorities are saying you can't make it in America. What they really mean is that they refuse to start at the bottom of the ladder the way you did. They want to surpass you. They want it handed to them." Eyeing the state of affairs, political scientist Andrew Hacker announced in 1970 the end of the American era, arguing that the nation was no longer a nation, but a collection of 200 million egos. Nixon, whose strength had always been in foreign policy, wasn't much interested in domestic policy, which he largely relegated to his aide, John Ehrlichman. He was interested, though, in using domestic policy to better divide his opponents. He called the welfare state building outhouses in Peoria. He chose to address unemployment and the growing ranks of welfare recipients with a proposal first made by the University of Chicago economist Milton Friedman in the 1950s. His chief domestic initiative, announced in August of 1969, was a guaranteed income program that he called the Family Assistance Plan. It would have eradicated the welfare system and eliminated social workers and many social programs and replaced them with a cash payment to everyone earning below a certain wage level. Unlike the existing welfare program, the Family Assistance Plan provided an incentive for the poor to work. The cash payment rose with income level. When a Gallup poll asked, "Would you favor or oppose such a plan?" 62% said they would oppose it. During Nixon's first term, opposition within policy circles grew. Conservatives objected to the Family Assistance Plan because it was a government handout. The left, especially the National Welfare Rights Organization, objected to it because it wasn't generous enough. "Zap, fap," read their placards. Nixon enjoyed watching them battle it out, and when the time was right for him politically, he abandoned it. "Make a big play for the plan," he told Haldeman, "but be sure it's killed by Democrats." Nixon's machinations with Congress weren't all that much more cynical than those of some other American presidents, but his commitment to making sure the American people didn't trust one another really was something distinctive. He often charged Agnew with the nastier part of this work, especially when it came to attacking the press and liberal intellectuals. "Dividing the American people has been my main contribution to the national political scene," Agnew later said. "I not only plead guilty to this charge, but I'm somewhat flattered by it." Many of the means Nixon used to discredit and attack his opponents, both at home and abroad, involved abuses of power that had become commonplace during the Cold War, when anti-communist hysteria and the urgency of national security had triumphed over judgment and the rule of law. Other Cold War presidents had used the CIA to conduct covert operations abroad, the FBI to spy on American citizens, and the IRS to audit political opponents. But Nixon got found out, partly due to his own paranoia, insecurity, and recklessness. And the proof of his duplicity, in the form of tape recordings made in the White House, brought a new kind of historical evidence not only into the archives, but into the public mind, a species of evidence much more intimate and unchecked than the collection of self-conscious memos and self-serving memoirs that chronicle most presidencies. The tapes would ultimately lead to impeachment proceedings and Nixon's resignation, but they also altered how Americans understood the presidency, since they altered the historical record, granting a view of even the most casual conversations, which very frequently revealed Nixon's bigotry, suspicion, and mean-spiritedness. Consider a conversation between Nixon and Haldeman about the television talk show host Dick Cavett in June 1971. Haldeman: "We've got a running war going with Cavett." Nixon: "Is he just a left-winger? Is that the problem?" Haldeman: "Yeah." Nixon: "Is he Jewish?" Haldeman: "I don't know. He doesn't look it." FDR had holes drilled in the Oval Office floor to allow wires for recording press conferences. Truman had used a microphone hidden in a lampshade on his desk. Eisenhower had recorded conversations in the Oval Office and bugged his own telephone. Kennedy and Johnson used a recording system installed by the U.S. Army Signal Corps. Nixon, after his inauguration, had ordered Johnson's system dismantled. He didn't like having to remember to turn the switch off and on. Still, his Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, had secretaries listen into meetings and take notes. In the end, a recording system seemed simpler than a fleet of secretaries, but because Nixon wanted the tapes to serve as a full and accurate chronicle of his presidency, he wanted a system that turned on automatically at the slightest noise. Early in 1971, Haldeman installed a new secret tape recording system that was voice-activated and highly sensitive to record meetings and telephone conversations in the Oval Office, the Lincoln Sitting Room, and the Cabinet Room. Only Nixon and Haldeman knew about the system. Kissinger and John Ehrlichman were among those who did not. During the very months that Haldeman was arranging for the new recording system at the White House, Daniel Ellsberg, a defense analyst, had been trying to find a way to release to the public a 7,000-page, 47-volume study of the war in Vietnam that had been commissioned by Robert McNamara in 1967, not long before he announced his resignation. The Pentagon Papers, as the report came to be called, was a chronicle of the lies and blunders of one administration after another in pursuing an ill-considered, cruel, and wanton campaign in Vietnam. Ellsberg, who had worked on the report, had made a set of photocopies in hopes that their exposure would bring an end to the war. Beginning in 1969, he had tried to gain the interest of members of Nixon's administration, including Kissinger, to no avail. He had tried to get a member of Congress to leak the report without success. He finally approached the New York Times early in 1971. The paper began publishing excerpts of the report on June 13th. Four succeeding administrations built up the American political, military, and psychological stakes in Indochina, the Times reported, introducing the chronicle of a decades-long conflict that the U.S. government had conducted to maintain the power, influence, and prestige of the United States, irrespective of conditions in Vietnam. The Pentagon Papers did not indict the Nixon administration. The study ended in 1968. If anything, the release of the papers strengthened Nixon's hand, allowing him to blame Vietnam on Kennedy and Johnson. But Nixon's aides understood the implications of the leaked study. "To the ordinary guy, this is all a bunch of gobbledygook," Haldeman told him. "But out of this gobbledygook comes a very clear thing. You can't trust the government. You can't believe what they say, and you can't rely on their judgment." Nixon, who harbored deep fears of being found out about anything, became convinced that Ellsberg's leak to the Times was part of a conspiracy against him, a Jewish cabal, as he described it, the same media that supported Hiss. His aides did not disabuse him of this theory. Kissinger, a German Jew, warned him, "If this thing flies, they're going to do the same to you." Kissinger convinced Nixon to ask the Justice Department to forbid the Times to publish any further portions of the report. While that case made its way to the Supreme Court, the Washington Post began publishing the papers. On June 30th, the Supreme Court ruled that the publication of the papers could continue. The Justice Department nevertheless proceeded with charges against Ellsberg. Faced with the possibility that their political opponents were gaining power, other presidents had simply called up J. Edgar Hoover and put the FBI on the case. But after the release of the Pentagon Papers, Hoover had grown cautious about engaging in unlawful surveillance and other, still less licit, tactics. The Nixon administration was left to do its own dirty work, much of which it also managed to capture on tape, as when, in July 1971, Nixon ordered his staff to blow up a safe at the Brookings Institution to find files about Vietnam that would embarrass Johnson, a measure motivated by nothing but malice since he'd been out of office for over 2 years. The administration also established a special investigations unit headed by a zealot and former aide of Ehrlichman's named G. Gordon Liddy, who was subsequently sent to work for the Committee to Re-elect the President, CRP, popularly known as CREEP. On Saturday, June 17, 1972, Liddy directed five men to break into the offices of Lawrence O'Brien, the DNC chairman, at the Watergate Hotel, to steal documents and repair wiretaps that had earlier been placed in office phones. After finishing that job, the burglars were supposed to proceed to the headquarters of the George McGovern campaign on Capitol Hill to do much the same, but they never got there because they were arrested at the Watergate Hotel. Nixon hadn't known about the break-in before it happened, but 6 days later, on June 23rd, he was captured on tape discussing a cover-up with Haldeman. While the Nixon administration conducted its cover-up in secrecy, secure in its expectation that the president could use executive privilege to prevent anyone from ever hearing anything on its tape recordings, the Nixon re-election campaign proceeded. In November 1972, Nixon won 61% of the popular vote and became the first presidential candidate to win 49 states, losing only Massachusetts and Washington, D.C. to McGovern. Both Nixon's neediness and the way his hunger for approval was fed by his aides are richly illustrated in a conversation he had with Kissinger following McGovern's concession speech, which Nixon considered too scanty in its acknowledgment of his own victory. Nixon called McGovern a prick. Nixon: "Don't you agree?" Kissinger: "Absolutely. He was ungenerous." Nixon: "Yeah." Kissinger: "He was petulant." Nixon: "Yeah." Kissinger: "Unworthy." Nixon: "Right. As you probably know, I responded in a very decent way to him." Kissinger: "Well, I thought that was a great statement. Year after year, the media were harassing you, all the intellectuals are against you, and you've come around." Nixon: "That's right." Kissinger: "And had the greatest victory." 5 days before his inauguration, in January 1973, Nixon announced the end of the war in Vietnam. The peace treaty would be signed in Paris later that month. In his inaugural address on the 20th, he heralded the beginning of a new era of peace and progress driven by a conservative revolution. "Abroad and at home, the time has come to turn away from the condescending policies of paternalism of Washington knows best," he said. "Let us encourage individuals at home and nations abroad to do more for themselves, to decide more for themselves." If Americans had trusted too much in government, this wasn't because government couldn't be trusted, because presidents had lied to the American people. This was because people should do more for themselves. The atrocities waged in the name of the American people in Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos, The chaos on the American streets, these were not the fault of elected officials who made grave mistakes, lied to the press, and obstructed justice. These things were the faults of liberalism, which had taught Americans to expect too much of government. And trusting too much in government, we have asked more of it than it can deliver, Nixon declared. This leads only to inflated expectations, to reduced individual effort, and to a disappointment and frustration that erode confidence both in what governments can do and in what people can do. Kennedy had urged Americans, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. Nixon urged Americans to ask what they could do for themselves. 2 days after the inauguration, Lyndon Johnson, 64, had a heart attack in his ranch in Texas. Johnson, who had given up his 60 cigarettes a day habit after his first heart attack in 1955, had smoked his first cigarette in 14 years on the plane ride home from Nixon's first inauguration. Alone at home on January 22nd, seized with pains in his chest, he telephoned for help, but help arrived too late. 10 days before his death, in his last interview with Walter Cronkite, a weary Johnson in a button-down flannel shirt and thick, wire-framed eyeglasses had talked with a swelling pride about the role he'd played in advancing civil rights, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, the Fair Housing Act of 1968, the We Shall Overcome speech he'd made during the crisis at Selma, and his 1967 appointment of Thurgood Marshall to the Supreme Court. We're living in a fast age, and all of us are rather impatient. And more important, we're rather intolerant of the opinions of our fellow man and his judgments and his conduct and his traditions and his way of life, Johnson told Cronkite, his languid voice heavy with pain. When Johnson died, Thurgood Marshall said, he died of a broken heart. Nixon's own collapse came more slowly, a festering, self-inflicted wound. In February, the Senate voted to convene a special committee to investigate the Watergate burglary. In May, Nixon's incoming Attorney General, Elliot Richardson, named Archibald Cox as a special prosecutor. In July, the Senate committee learned about the tapes, but when Cox subpoenaed them, Nixon refused to turn them over, citing executive privilege. The cover-up had gone badly. Charges against Ellsberg were dropped when the Watergate investigation revealed that Liddy's operatives had broken into the office of Ellsberg's psychiatrist in California. Still, Nixon had little fear of impeachment with a notoriously corrupt and much despised Agnew as his vice president. He called Agnew the assassin's dilemma. But in October, Agnew pled no contest to a charge of tax evasion and resigned. 10 days later, in what became known as the Saturday Night Massacre, Nixon told Richardson to fire Cox. When Richardson refused and resigned instead, Nixon told Deputy Attorney General William Ruckelhaus to do it. Ruckelhaus also resigned. Finally, Nixon got Solicitor General Robert Bork to fire Cox, an abusive power that would haunt Bork, the FBI, and the Justice Department itself. Act like a winner, Nixon wrote in a note to himself, listing his New Year's resolutions. But his efforts to block the release of the tapes failed. Finally, in April 1974, he released 1,200 pages of transcripts to 46 tapes. The public discovered the nature of Nixon's wrath, his pettiness, and his vengefulness. But the June 23, 1972 transcripts were not included, and when the committee demanded them, the White House refused, and the case went to the Supreme Court in United States versus Nixon. While the justices were deliberating, 83-year-old Earl Warren, who had retired from the court 5 years before, had a heart attack. On July 9th, Justices William O. Douglas and William J. Brennan went to see him at Georgetown University Hospital. Warren grabbed Douglas's hand. If Nixon is not forced to turn over tapes of his conversations with the ring of men who were conversing on their violations of the law, Warren warned, then liberty will soon be dead in this nation. Brennan and Douglas assured him that the court would order the president to hand over the tapes. Warren died hours later. The Supreme Court delivered its unanimous opinion on July 24th. Nixon nominee William Rehnquist recused himself. The White House had to release the tapes. The content of the tapes was reported on August 6th, 1974. Impeachment seemed almost certain. To avoid it, Nixon announced his resignation the next day, speaking into television cameras from his desk at the White House. In a brief, curt speech, he touted his foreign policy achievements, which were many, and of deep and abiding significance. He'd opened diplomatic relations with China after a quarter century. For all that he'd done to prolong it, he had in fact ended the war in Vietnam. He'd improved U.S. relations in the Middle East. He'd negotiated arms limitation agreements with the Soviet Union, building on relationships he'd established in his trip to Moscow in 1959. He said nearly nothing about conditions in the United States, except to allude to the turbulent history of this era, a turbulence he had done little to alleviate and much to aggravate. The next morning, bidding farewell to his White House staff, he said, "Always remember, others may hate you, but those who hate you don't win unless you hate them, and then you destroy yourself." Then, carrying on his stooped shoulders the weight of a troubled nation, he walked down a red carpet on the south lawn to a waiting helicopter, climbed the stairs to its open door, and turned back to deliver his trademark wave, spreading both arms wide. Disappearing inside, he flew away, last seen peering out through a bulletproof window as the whirling helicopter wended its way toward the Washington Monument and over the National Mall, where another man had not so very long ago told a story about a dream. Chapter 15. Battle Lines. Betty Ford and Morley Safer were sitting on either end of a floral sofa in the solarium on the third floor of the White House on a summer's day in 1975, when the CBS 60 Minutes reporter asked the First Lady what she thought about equal rights and abortion. Safer wore a black suit. Ford, a former fashion model and dancer with the Martha Graham Dance Company, wore a beige dress, a belted, gathered smock with a yoked neck. Safer kept apologizing for asking questions about subjects that he described as taboo, but Ford answered each question with candor, even though her answers were often at odds with the views of her husband and increasingly of the Republican Party. After the president watched the hour-long interview, he told his wife, "Well, honey, there goes about 20 million votes." He was not entirely wrong. Betty Ford's 60 Minutes interview came 2 years after the Supreme Court's decision in Roe v. Wade, and at a moment when the Equal Rights Amendment seemed mere months away from becoming law. These two issues would together produce the greatest cleavage in American politics since the debate over slavery. The origins of the dispute lie in the Constitution itself, but a turning point came in 1963, a year that saw the publication of both Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique and American Women, the official report of the Commission on the Status of Women. The commission, chaired by Eleanor Roosevelt and including Pauli Murray, had been established by JFK in 1961, a step he took to quiet the complaint that he was the first president since Hoover whose cabinet did not include a woman. In The Feminine Mystique, Friedan lamented the problem that has no name, the suffering of gingham-aproned housewives, frustrated, lonely, and bored. "Each suburban wife struggled with it alone," she wrote. Betty Ford had that problem. A congressional wife raising four children, Ford began mixing alcohol and painkillers in 1964 and had a nervous breakdown in 1965, the year her husband assumed a new national prominence. "Congress got a new minority leader and I lost a husband," she later said. While Ford struggled with loneliness, Friedan and Murray led a small group of women and men who established the National Organization for Women in 1966. The next year, NOW made the ERA its top priority and added to its agenda the legalization of abortion. Nothing about equal rights for women, contraception, or abortion is inherently partisan. The public was divided on many issues relating to women, but in the 1960s and 1970s, and well into the 1980s, those divisions did not follow along party lines. Only in 1980 did the leadership of the two parties place legalized abortion on their platforms, Republicans against and Democrats in favor. In the 1976 platforms, both parties equivocated on the issue. But by the 1990s, abortion had become an overwhelmingly partisan issue, a defining issue of a widening divide. Nor were gun ownership and gun safety legislation partisan issues before the 1970s. But during that decade, political strategists took up the work of making guns partisan, too. In truth, the very character of partisanship changed. Paul Weyrich, a conservative strategist and founder of the Heritage Foundation, announced a new war. "It is a war of ideology, it is a war of ideas, and it is a war about our way of life," Weyrich said. "And it has to be fought with the same intensity, I think, and dedication as you would fight a shooting war." In the waning decades of the 20th century, liberals and conservatives alike cast the lingering divisions of the 1960s less as matters of law and order than as matters of life and death. Either abortion was murder and guns meant freedom, or guns meant murder and abortion was freedom. How this sorted out came to depend upon party affiliation. The economy, stupid, became the mantra of Bill Clinton's 1992 presidential campaign when he tried to set aside the guns and abortion divide. That proved impossible. Especially after the Cold War came to an end, a domestic Cold War began, uncompromising, all or nothing, murder or freedom, life or death. 1. Making social issues into partisan issues took a great deal of work, much of it done by political strategists and well-paid political consultants, and made easier by mainframe and desktop computers. By the 1970s, the lie factory that had begun manufacturing public opinion in the 1930s, when Campaigns Inc. opened its doors and George Gallup started conducting polls, had grown into a billion-dollar industry that divided the electorate by inciting outrage, having demonstrated that the more emotional the issue, the likelier voters were to turn up at the polls. And the most emotional issues, those most likely to get out the vote, turned out to be abortion and guns. In the first decades of the 21st century, the Internet would come to function as a polarization machine, fast, efficient, and cheap, and all but automated. But in the last decades of the 20th century, the work was still done manually. Quite how much labor and money went into that project can only be appreciated by how differently issues like abortion and guns looked before the work began. Before the 1980s, neither the ERA nor women's health were partisan issues, except insofar as Republicans had historically offered more support to equal rights and family planning than had Democrats. Planned Parenthood, the birth control organization founded by Margaret Sanger in 1916, had forced her out decades before her death in 1966, objecting to her feminism. Beginning in the 1920s, its leaders had been more Republican than Democrat. By the 1950s, many were conservatives. Barry Goldwater and his wife served on the board of Planned Parenthood in Phoenix, family planning having become, politically speaking, a family value. In campaigning for the legalization of contraception, Planned Parenthood also enjoyed the broad support of both doctors and clergymen. In 1958, Alan F. Guttmacher, chief of obstetrics at Mount Sinai Hospital, clinical professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Columbia, and a member of Planned Parenthood's medical advisory board, challenged New York City municipal hospitals to reverse an institutional policy that forbade doctors from giving out contraceptives or contraceptive information. Hospital chaplains lined up behind him. In 1960, Planned Parenthood's Clergymen's National Advisory Council issued a statement, "The Ethics of Family Planning," describing family planning as fulfilling the will of God by allowing married couples to enjoy intercourse for the sake of love. Efforts to legalize abortion were begun in the 1960s, not by women's rights activists, but by the doctors, lawyers, and clergymen who ran Planned Parenthood. In 1962, when Guttmacher became president of Planned Parenthood, he launched a campaign to secure federal government support for family planning programs for the poor, to overturn bans on contraception, and to liberalize abortion law. In 1965, former Presidents Eisenhower and Truman, Republican and Democrat, together served as co-chairmen of a Planned Parenthood committee, signaling an across-the-aisle commitment to contraception. That year, in Griswold v. Connecticut, the Supreme Court struck down state bans on contraception, overturning the conviction of Estelle Griswold, the head of a Planned Parenthood clinic in Connecticut, who'd been arrested for dispensing contraception. It had been nearly 50 years since Sanger had been arrested on the same charges, but the right to contraception secured in Griswold would turn out to be fragile. The men who wrote and ratified the Constitution had left women, sex, and marriage out of it. "Remember the ladies," Abigail Adams had warned her husband in 1776, advice he had ignored. The consequences of writing women out of the Republic's founding documents were both lasting and devastating. That the framers of the Constitution had not resolved the question of slavery had led to a civil war. That they regarded women as unequal to men nearly did the same. Over the course of American history, women had often written themselves into the Constitution by way of analogy. Discrimination by sex was like discrimination by race, and language that barred one could be understood to bar another. This, however, was not the argument by which the Supreme Court granted to women the right to contraception and abortion. In Griswold, the court based its ruling not on equality, but instead on privacy. "We deal with a right of privacy older than the Bill of Rights," Justice Douglas had said in the majority opinion. Although no right to privacy is mentioned in either the Constitution or the Bill of Rights, Douglas maintained that it is nevertheless there, not in words, but in the shadow cast by words, in penumbras formed by emanations from those guarantees that help give them life and substance. This would prove a dangerously imperfect support for the many cases that would try to build upon Griswold over the next half century. In 1969, Nixon had asked Congress to increase federal funding for family planning. And in the House, George H.W. Bush, a decorated Navy pilot and young Republican congressman from Texas, pressed the case. "We need to make family planning a household word," Bush said. So known was Bush for his support of family planning that he got the nickname Rubbers. In 1972, in Eisenstadt v. Baird, the court extended Griswold's notion of privacy from married couples to individuals. "If the right of privacy means anything," Justice Brennan wrote, "it is the right of the individual, married or single, to be free from unwarranted governmental intrusion into matters so fundamentally affecting a person as the decision whether to bear or beget a child." Between 1967 and 1970, under pressure from doctors and lawyers, often supported by clergy, legislators began lifting restrictions on abortion in 16 states, including California, where the law was signed by Governor Reagan. When the Catholic Church objected to New York's new abortion law, in apocalyptic terms, Protestant and Jewish clergy asked whether the cause of ecumenism is best served by attributing to us the advocacy of murder and genocide. In 1970, Nixon signed Title X, which included a provision under which doctors on military bases could perform abortions. "No American woman should be denied access to family planning assistance because of her economic condition," Nixon declared that year. But if a broad bipartisan political consensus supported family planning, women themselves had grown divided over many other matters. The women's movement of the 1960s and 1970s was really three movements: radical feminism, liberal feminism, and conservative anti-feminism. The radical women's movement came out of the New Left, where women had found precious little support for arguments about the oppression of women. "Let them eat cock," said one Berkeley student leader. Stokely Carmichael, asked about the position of women in the Black Power movement, answered, "The only position for women in the movement is prone." Radical feminists fought for liberation from the bondage of womanhood, the shackles of femininity. Their arguments, at first Marxist and economic, turned swiftly to culture. Emblematically, Shulamith Firestone of the New York Radical Women held a funeral for traditional womanhood, burying a mannequin with blonde hair and curlers. Firestone's form of guerrilla theater gained a national audience in 1968 during a protest of the Miss America contest, when radical feminists crowned a sheep, Miss America, burned girdles, high-heeled shoes, and Playboy magazine in a trash can, and unfurled a women's liberation banner shouting, "Freedom for women!" Carmichael notwithstanding, radical feminism had been deeply influenced by the Black Power movement, with its disdain for liberalism and its emphasis on separatism and pride, and had close ties, too, to the nascent gay rights movement, which had begun in the 1950s but grew in strength and intensity over the course of the next decade. In 1965, lesbian and gay rights activists picketed the United Nations, Philadelphia's Independence Hall, and the White House three times. In 1968, at a homosexual rights conference in Chicago, participants, inspired by "Black is Beautiful," declared, "Gay is good." A year after a 1969 police raid of New York's Stonewall Inn, homosexual rights groups held a march from Greenwich Village to Central Park. "We have to come out into the open and stop being ashamed, or else people will treat us like freaks," said one activist. "This march is an affirmation and declaration of our new pride." Liberal feminists, by contrast, drew inspiration and borrowed tactics from the suffrage, abolition, and pre-Black Power civil rights movements. In pursuit of equal rights, they wanted to pass laws, amend the Constitution, win court cases, and get women elected to office. In 1971, writer Gloria Steinem, Republican organizer Tanya Melich, and New York Congresswomen Bella Abzug and Shirley Chisholm founded the bipartisan National Women's Political Caucus. The next year, a record-breaking number of women ran for office, including Chisholm, who sought the Democratic presidential nomination, and they kept on running. Between 1970 and 1975, the number of women in elected office doubled. The 92nd Congress, which met from 1971 to 1972, passed more women's rights bills than any other Congress, including Title IX and a federal child care bill, which Nixon vetoed. The ERA, first introduced into Congress in 1923, passed in the House in 1971, 354-24, and in the Senate in 1972, 84-8. Sent to the states for ratification, it won by enormous margins, 205-7 in liberal Massachusetts, 31-0 in conservative West Virginia, 61-0 in independent Colorado. Liberal feminists made striking gains, too, in the courts, many of them won by Ruth Bader Ginsburg, a brilliant young law school professor born in Brooklyn to Jewish immigrants in 1933. Ginsburg began arguing equal rights cases before the Supreme Court in 1971, relying on and citing Pauli Murray's strategy for using the 14th Amendment to defeat discrimination by sex. Weren't women, after all, persons? The next year, Ginsburg launched the ACLU's Women's Rights Project. "I ask no favor for my sex," she told the 9 male justices in 1973, quoting the eloquent abolitionist Sarah Grimke. "All I ask of our brethren is that they take their feet off our necks." A conservative women's movement, best understood as a form of anti-feminism, came last, a reaction to both radical and liberal feminism, and to the lifting of bans on contraception and the liberalization of abortion laws. In 1970, a woman from Fort Wayne, Indiana, as if conjuring up the ghost of 19th-century anti-vice crusader Anthony Comstock, wrote to Guttmacher, "Everyone is asking, what is wrong with our young people in this generation? Well, I can tell you what is wrong. They're being fed garbage and filth from dirty books, magazines, and movies. But the most tragic thing of all is the fact that many churchmen have joined in these non-Christian intellectuals in a new attitude toward sex. It is one of the great tragedies of our day, and God will surely hold them responsible." The Constitution, whose framers did not believe women to be political subjects, offered very little guidance. "There is nothing in the United States Constitution concerning birth, contraception, or abortion," Jay Floyd, Texas Assistant Attorney General, told the court in Roe v. Wade when the case was first argued in 1971. Floyd spoke on behalf of Wade County, Texas, defending its anti-abortion statute. Floyd was right, but there is also nothing in the Constitution about a great many things on which the court had ruled, from segregated schools to wiretapping. The question became what legal doctrine would be used to talk about the bodies of people that the framers of the Constitution had understood as subject to the rule of men. Men enter the courts as citizens of the Republic. Women enter the courts as citizens by sufferance. Sarah Weddington, the attorney for Jane Roe, a Texas woman who had sought an abortion, was willing to use any kind of argument the court would accept: liberty, equality, privacy, the First Amendment, the Ninth, the 14th, or the 19th, whatever would work. Asked by Justice Potter Stewart where in the Constitution she placed her argument, she pointed out that the privacy right established in Griswold seemed a terribly weak foundation on which to build her case. Certainly, under the Griswold decision, it appears that members of the court in that case were obviously divided as to the specific constitutional framework of the right which they held to exist in the Griswold decision, Weddington said. She had a few other ideas. "I do feel that the Ninth Amendment is an appropriate place for the freedom to rest," she told the court. "I think the 14th Amendment is an equally appropriate place." Justice Stewart tried to nail her down. Did she mean to rely on the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment? "We had originally brought the suit alleging both the Due Process Clause, Equal Protection Clause, the Ninth Amendment, and a variety of others," Weddington answered. "And anything else that might be applicable?" Stewart asked. "Yes, right," said Weddington. As the court neared a ruling on Roe, Nixon's advisors saw a political opportunity. In 1971, Nixon's speechwriter Patrick Buchanan told the president that abortion was a rising issue and a gut issue with Catholics, and suggested that the president's prospects for re-election would be improved if the president should publicly take his stand against abortion as offensive to his own moral principles. A week later, Nixon, jettisoning his previous support of abortion, issued a statement in which he referred to his personal belief in the sanctity of human life, including the life of the yet unborn. Exploiting Catholics' opposition to abortion was a deliberate attempt to inject doctrinal absolutism into party politics. Nixon supporters complained and asked whether Nixon might perhaps return to his original position. Buchanan waved that objection aside. "He'll cost himself Catholic support and gain what, Betty Friedan?" The Supreme Court handed down its decision in Roe v. Wade on January 22, 1973, the day LBJ died, finding that the right of privacy is broad enough to encompass a woman's decision whether or not to terminate her pregnancy. It would turn out to be a monumental decision, salvation to some, sin to others. In the White House, the casual viciousness of the president was caught on tape the next day, when Nixon shared his thoughts on the ruling with an aide. "There are times when abortions are necessary," he said, casting aside in private his public invocation of the sanctity of life. "Abortion was necessary in cases of rape, for instance," he said, or, here offering his frank private views on race, "in case of a pregnancy resulting from sex between a black and a white." Betty Ford, unlike Nixon, didn't express her true views about abortion only behind closed doors. From the moment her husband took office, hours after Nixon resigned, she had been candid about women's rights, abortion, and women's health. She held regular press conferences, something no First Lady had done since Eleanor Roosevelt. Only weeks after she moved into the White House, she found out she had breast cancer and needed an emergency mastectomy. Determined not to be a part of a cover-up and to help save the lives of women by encouraging them to get tested, Breast cancer was at the time the number one killer of women between the ages of 25 and 45. She disclosed her condition and allowed herself to be photographed during her recovery. "I thought, there are women all over the country like me," she said, "and if I don't make this public, then their lives will be gone or in jeopardy." She earned an intensely loyal following among voters, but especially among women. Ford's vocal support of the ERA was equally well known. She spent a great deal of her time making calls to states debating ratification. Protesters outside the White House carried signs that read, "Betty Ford, get off the phone!" This caused some strain between the East and West wings of the White House, but the president refused to submit to pressure to quiet his wife and instead joked, "I say one wrong thing about women's rights and the next state dinner is at McDonald's." In the summer of 1975, when Betty Ford sat on that floral sofa with Morley Safer, she did not hold back. "I feel that the Equal Rights Amendment ought to probably pass in our bicentennial year," she said, hoping for ratification in 1976. He asked her about abortion. She cited Roe v. Wade. "I feel very strongly that it was the best thing in the world when the Supreme Court voted to legalize abortion, and in my words, bring it out of the backwoods and put it in the hospitals where it belongs. I thought it was a great, great decision." Neither Betty Ford nor Morley Safer appreciated how tightly these two issues were being wound together by Phyllis Schlafly, the anti-communist crusader, McCarthy supporter, and Goldwater promoter. Having been ousted from Republican Party leadership, Schlafly turned her attention and prodigious organizing skills to defeating equal rights for women by attaching the ERA to Roe v. Wade. Read a headline in a typical issue of the Phyllis Schlafly Report in 1974, "ERA means abortion and population shrinkage." Betty Ford, ill-judging her adversary, dismissed the Radcliffe-educated Phyllis Schlafly as a crank. Asked whether she'd agree to debate her, the First Lady said, "I wouldn't waste my time." Schlafly, blonde and petite, wore flawlessly pressed pink skirt suits and pumps. She liked to talk about herself as a housewife and mother of six, but she was also ruthless and she was learned, and people who underestimated her nearly always regretted it. Tying the ERA to abortion was a stroke of political genius. To better debate her opponents, and realizing that much of this political battle would be waged in the courts, Schlafly earned a law degree in the 1970s. She was not a flake. She was as keen as the most cunning battlefield general. Conservatives had been trying since the 1930s to dismantle the New Deal coalition and to take over the Republican Party. In the 1970s and 1980s, by bringing Catholics, evangelical Christians, and white Southern Democrats into their own coalition, they finally succeeded. No small number of conservative political strategists would take credit for this achievement, but it was Schlafly who built the road to the Reagan Revolution, paving it with stones labeled "End Abortion Now" and "Stop ERA." 2 centuries had passed since Thomas Jefferson declared all men to be equal. "Well, Jerry, I guess we've healed America," Gerald Ford told himself as he fell asleep on the 4th of July, 1976, after watching a stirring display of fireworks over the Washington Monument on the nation's bicentennial. But the scars of Vietnam and Watergate had not healed. The electorate was growing increasingly polarized, Americans' trust in government had not recovered, and the economy had stalled. Had American growth peaked? All nations have a rise. In the 1970s, many Americans began to wonder whether their nation's fall had begun. Were its best days in the past? Had its ideals failed? The economic and moral downturn that would be called a malaise during the administration of Democratic President Jimmy Carter, elected in 1976, first became visible to most Americans in 1973 during the OPEC oil embargo. In a matter of months, the cost of gasoline increased by a factor of 5, driving up the price of other goods too. In 9 months in 1974, the Dow lost 37% of its value. Japanese automobile manufacturers producing more fuel-efficient cars outcompeted Detroit. Heavy industries, especially steel, closed their doors or moved to other countries, creating what came to be called the Rust Belt in the Midwest. Economists had to come up with a new name, stagflation, for the strange and puzzling new mix of slow economic growth, high unemployment, and rising inflation that afflicted the American economy in the 1970s. Liberals blamed the malaise on Nixon and on the abandonment of Johnson's Great Society programs, arguing that if the economy was worsening, it must be because the liberal economic agenda remained unfinished. Conservatives understood the state of the economy as evidence not of the unfinished work of liberalism, but of liberalism's failure and of the wrongheadedness of Keynesian economics, Economic planning, taxation, and government regulation, they argued, had shackled the free market. One explanation that fits some of the evidence, if not all of it, is that the century of economic growth that had begun in 1870 had been driven by inventions, from electricity to the automobile, and was not sustainable. After 1970, the pace of invention slowed and its consequences narrowed. Delivering electricity, gas, telephone, water, and sewer, power, warmth, communication, cleanliness, to every home in the United States, a project completed by about 1940, had ended isolation and produced astonishing improvements in living conditions and economic output. Medical advances made before 1970.